All right, you ready for the launch button? Let's do this. If you open your Bible up, if you have your chronological Bible, to September 24th, which is where we'll be reading starting tomorrow, I just want to highlight something that you might miss as you get excited and start into your reading. But as you look at September 24th, in just a little print, it says this: 400 years after the last Old Testament book was written, the story of the New Testament began to unfold around 6 BC. There was a 400-year period from when the Old Testament was completed. So if you look back, that last page was Joel 3. That's probably, his, in a timeline, chronologically, probably the last book that was written in the Old Testament. There was 400 years when there was not a prophetic voice in the nation of Israel. There was really, heaven was silent, if you want to say that, for 400 years. And I don't want us to overlook the significance of that as we start into this course tonight, because there had been 400 years of waiting for the voice of the Lord. And we're going to talk specifically tonight about that period, oftentimes by scholars called the 400 years of silence. Because I want to go through that historically tonight, because even though there's no biblical record of the 400 years, there's lots of history. We know what was going on during that period in the Middle East. So I'm going to go through that tonight and hopefully help set the stage in this first half for when you hit the ground reading this tomorrow or this next week, you'll have an appreciation for how significant some of the events that we read will be in there. So I'm going to talk about those 400 years of silence. Understanding what was going on during this period is so helpful in understanding the Gospels. The first thing I want to talk about a little bit is the geography of Israel in the Middle East. If you know the map, there's the Mediterranean Sea, and you've got the nation of Israel off to the right, just above Egypt. And what's so unique about the Jewish nation and the Jewish homeland and the history of the Jewish people is they were in this narrow funnel, if you want to call it that, where there was all these nations north of them, and Egypt and Africa and all these nations below them. But what is to the right of Israel? Geographically, desert, a huge desert that's very, very difficult to get across. It's difficult to take an army, almost impossible. It's hard to move large groups of people. So what we have to realize, even in the history of Israel, is throughout history, anytime somebody was mad up north and was getting mad at somebody in the south, where did they have to go through to get there? They had to go through Israel. Or if somebody in the south was mad and wanted to take over somebody north, what did they have to do? They marched their armies through Israel. So the Jews kind of don't get a break, if you want to say, looking at like thousands of years of history. It's a very unique place. The Mediterranean Sea was a huge way to transport troops and people and goods, of course. But I just learned in my reading the last couple weeks that keels had not been invented at the time of the New Testament. So you couldn't sail into the wind. You could only sail downwind. So when the Bible says, and the season wasn't right, I never understood that, you couldn't sail into the wind. So you had to march your armies certain times a year in geographic way. And the only way to get through is that narrow little funnel that went through Palestine. So when you think about the history of the nation of Israel, that's a reality we can't overlook. Everybody who was mad at somebody else went through your neighborhood on their way. This is a quick way to say it. So as we talk about the end of the Old Testament, roughly 400 BC, the Persians were in charge of the Middle East. We got a second, I can't resist. Let me go farther back. I'll give you a quick history. Abraham, remember him? One little guy, comes out of the north. God says, I'll give you a land, seed blessing. Can't even have a kid. That's a big start for the nation of Israel, right? Him, his son, Abraham, what's the son's name was? Isaac and Jacob. Never even had any land. They were foreigners in this land and wandered around. They'd buy a cave to bury their dead or whatever once in a while, but they had nothing. They were being controlled by the other people. And then, of course, Joseph comes along and rescues Egypt in the time of famine. And Israel, now named Israel, goes down, and they thrive for 400 years in the nation of Egypt and just go crazy in terms of population, become a nation. But the bad news is they were slaves. So they didn't have any control. We know the story of the Exodus. God brings them out, and he brings them into the land. And for many generations, they were ruled by judges. So there was a problem. So the Midianites, whoever came in, tried to take over. The judge was raised up. And then later on, all went back. There's this whole cycle in the book of Judges. It's a big mess. It wasn't a real fun time to be in Israel because you're either getting whooped or getting ready to get whooped by somebody else in the area. So it's a very difficult time. But then the what's called the United Monarchy started. And who was the first king of Israel?
Saul.
Under Saul and David and his son Solomon, that was an amazing time for Jews. They ran their own, they had their own destiny. They were in charge. It was a time, mostly, especially in the time of Solomon, of peace and prosperity. There was no world dominating powers that were messing them. Nobody was mad walking through, like I said, bringing armies through. That was an amazing time. That was the golden age for Israel, was during the period of United Monarchy. But when Saul died, his goofball son made a bad decision, and the wheels started to fall off, and the nation split into the northern tribes and the southern tribes called Israel and Judah. And Israel went off the rails spiritually real quick, and Judah wasn't far behind. That's where we see the stories of kings and all the screw-ups in there. And eventually, the Assyrians, major power way up in the north, gained control over the known world and came down, and they overtook and sacked the northern capital and almost sacked the southern Judah. But they got a message that the next group was starting to attack them at home, so they had to go up. So after the Assyrians had run over the land and taken control and exiled the northern kingdom, then the Babylonians came. And the Babylonians beat the Assyrians, and then right away, they're down, you know, thumping on the Jews and trying to get down to Egypt and take over Egypt, which they did. They eventually ended up sacking the southern kingdom, Jerusalem, and so they lost all control of their destiny. After that, the Persians took over from the Babylonians, and they came in and ran things, okay? So I just want you to see that except for that United Monarchy period, for the most of the history of the Jewish people, somebody else was in charge, and it wasn't pleasant. So they've had a hard history. But as we start the beginning of that 400 years in 400 B.C., that period of silence at the end of the Old Testament, the Persians were the ones that were in charge. So the Persians were in charge, and then after that, I'll just give you a quick overview and we'll go back and look at some things. After that, the Greeks rose to power. Alexander the Great, like in the early 300s BC, rose to power very quickly. So the Greeks took over from the Persians. They had a whole big thing that they ran. Alexander the Great died fairly young, and four Greek generals took over his whole kingdom and broke it into four different parts. And Palestine, where the Jews were, was the demilitarized zone between two of those kingdoms. So one was to the north and one was to the south in Egypt. Now, how many of you know living in the demilitarized zone is not a great place to be? How many of you want to camp out between North and South Korea? Everybody wants to shoot at you. Everybody wants a piece of your land as a buffer. Everybody wants to tax you, right? So it was a very difficult time when the Greek generals took over. And then after that, and we'll talk about this specifically more in a minute, but there was a brief period from about 142 BC to 63 BC where the Jews ruled themselves again. It's called the Maccabean period. There was a big revolt. We'll talk about it in a minute. So there was a little period of time after all those hundreds of years where they actually were in charge again. And then in 63 BC, the big guns show up. Who would that be? The ultimate bulldozer, the lockstep, the Romans show up and they take over Palestine in 63 BC. And then they're in charge for like 100 or 200 to 300 years, a long time. So there's this brief period of time in this intertestamental period where the Jews actually, nobody was trying to kill them. And they actually got to run, their own country, but not for very long. So they have a very, very challenging and difficult history when you think about the nation of the Jews and the people of God. So let's go back. What was life under the Persians like? I'm back to 400 BC. Now we're going to look at each of these time periods just for a second. The Persians, they were kind of slightly kinder and gentler than the Assyrians and the Babylonians. The Persians, even though they were a mighty army, they had to have some mean on to take over the known world. They were a little different in the sense that they allowed people to go back to their homelands. The Assyrians and the Babylonians just took whole populations and deported them. That was the way of controlling. They just mixed them in and you can't take over if you can't speak to your neighbors. So they figured, let's just mix the whole kingdom up. And so that's what happened. The Assyrians drug the northern kingdom off and the Babylonians drug the southern kingdom off. But the Persians were different. When you look at the beginning of the book of Ezra, Cyrus, who was a Persian king, he gives this edict that says, you can go back to the land and you can rebuild the land. Amazing, because that was a prophecy that was given by Isaiah a couple hundred years before that with the actual name of the leader. No one knew who Cyrus was or was going to be. Didn't even know the Persians were going to be in power. But Isaiah prophesied that, and then we see at the beginning of that period, they go back and rebuild the land. So they let the exiles return to their home countries if they chose to. And lots of the nations they allowed to go back to their countries. And that's where we see the Jews coming back. So a little bit, if you can say it, domination of an ungodly world power is a good thing. The Persians were maybe the best of the three. God caused these nations' rulers to show favor to the Jews. So remember the story, they allowed them to have wood to rebuild the temple and took the taxes and said, you know, you can use those for the rebuilding temple. The Persians were kind of like, we're going to make all the gods happy. So if you have a god, we want you to go back and make him happy, whatever he likes, and then it'll be good for us. That's kind of the Persians, right? It's like, we're not going to, we're just, let's make everybody happy. So that's kind of where you can see the Persians say, oh, you have the Yahweh, this God of the Old Testament? Brilliant. Go build a temple. Tell him we're the guys and we helped you and have favor for us. Shorthand for the Persians. But so that was in that beginning of that 400 period of silence, the Persians were in charge. Now, we talked about that after the Greeks took over, Alexander the Great. And we can't underestimate Greek culture. It's called Hellenism, is another way to say. It's a mix of Oriental, of Eastern and Western culture. The Greek language becomes the language of the commerce and of the street for really the whole Mediterranean area for this huge, huge thing. The New Testament was written in Greek, even though when it was written, the Romans were in charge. And officially, the Romans' language was Latin, but in reality, language of commerce and language of, you know, just living was Greek. So a commentator said the Romans may have conquered the Greeks militarily, but the Greeks actually conquered the Romans culturally. So we can't underestimate the influence of Greek culture. They took over and such an influence. They had a whole pantheon of gods. You know this whole Greek thing. You took it in grade six. You know, the gods are always, you know, fornicating with each other and killing each other and killing their fathers. And, you know, that's the whole Greek religious system is all these Greek gods. And that was really part of the whole Greek culture. But that Greek culture really took over in a significant way. After that, remember we talked about it broke up into four kingdoms. The kingdom that relates mostly to the Jewish nation was the kingdom called the Seleucids. That's one of those four generals that came in it. And that was a kingdom that was just slightly to the north of Israel. And the Seleucids seriously pushed Greek culture on the Jews. Matter of fact, all of those guys, those four generals, pushed Greek culture on everywhere they were around the world. They wanted to unify, and it was all about the Greek culture. They were on a mission to make people Greek. And the Seleucids were particularly that way. They pushed Greek culture. I'll just read you a little outtake. This is a great resource. It's called Survey of the New Testament. It's by Robert Gundry. We actually used this textbook a few years back. And if you want one volume that'll really give you a lot of cultural and historical and what did people eat and how did they dress and, you know, how did they get married, this is a great textbook. But I'll just read you a little just a little picture of an idea of how much of a mission the Seleucids were on. You know, this is, I'm talking about maybe 150, 175, 200 BC, so halfway through the silent period. But I'll just give you an idea. So this is talking about Jerusalem. The leader at that time built a gymnasium and an adjoining track where it was built. There, to the outrage of the strict Jews, Jewish lads exercised in the Greek fashion, nude. Track races opened with invocations to pagan deities. Even Jewish priests attended these events. Such Hellenization, that's the process of making people like Greeks, right? Hellenization also included attendance at Greek theaters, the adoption of Greek dress, surgery to disguise circumcision when exercising in the nude. Bad enough we have to get circumcised, and we have to get uncircumcised? Not interested in either. And the exchange of Hebrew names for Greek names. So Jews who opposed this paganization to their culture were called Hasidians, or pious people, roughly equivalent to Puritans. So during the Seleucid period, you know, 150, 175 BC, these guys were on a mission to stamp out Judaism and make it look very Greek. And so there was a lot of resistance. And eventually, a guy rose called Antiochus IV. He's also known as Antiochus Epiphanes. One of the baddest dudes in all of biblical history. This guy had such a hate on for the Jews. He sacrificed a pig on the altar in Jerusalem because he knew how horrible that would be for the Jewish people. They don't even eat pig. He set up temple prostitutes in the Jerusalem temple where you'd go in and have sex as worship to the pagan gods. And so you can imagine how the Jews just couldn't believe this violation of their sovereignty and of their religion. What he did was just, this guy was just incredibly, incredibly, he makes Hitler look like a choir boy. Antiochus IV or Antiochus Epiphanes. And eventually a persecution during that period broke out to the Jews. I'll just give you some illustration. This is pretty rough, but it's, I want you to hear it. So during this period, if you didn't bow down and in a sense kind of by the Greek line and the Greek culture, you wanted to retain your Judaism, here's what happened. Two women were brought for having circumcised their children. They publicly paraded them around the city with their babies hanging at their breasts and then hurled them down headlong from the wall. The king fell into a rage. He gave orders to have pans and cauldrons heated for seven brothers and their mother, already tortured with whips and thongs for refusing to eat pork. That was one of the things. Let's make the Jewish guys eat pork because that really makes them mad. Forbidden by the law of Moses. These were heated immediately, these hot pans. He commanded that the tongue of their spokesman be cut out, and they scalp him and cut off his hands and feet, while the rest of the brothers and mother looked on. When he was utterly helpless, the king ordered them to take him to the fire, still breathing, and fry him in a pan. The smoke from the pan spread widely, but the brothers and their mothers encouraged them to die nobly. There followed many similar gruesome martyrdoms, and the remaining brothers and their mother and their father and their husband have already been killed by being stretched apart on racks and beaten. So not the way to win friends and influence people. Antiochus Epiphanes and the Seleucids, very, very difficult time for the nation of Israel. And because that was such a horrible time, there rose up a revolt, an underground in within the Jews. And this is what's called the Maccabean Revolt, where the Jewish people said, I don't care what it takes, we're going to get these people out of our land. And so there was this revolt that developed and began about 167 BC. Now, the best thing I can help you see is Donald Trump. You know, a lot of people right now are going, oh! Half the people are so thrilled about Donald Trump and the other half are losing their minds, okay? That's the best kind of illustration I can give you for this Maccabean revolt. Because about half the people said, this is great, we're finally getting back to proper Judaism, kill them all. And the other half were like, well, now, wait a minute. Couldn't we just get along with this Greek culture? And so it was really a civil war that kind of developed. Not only were they fighting the Seleucids, they were fighting themselves during this Maccabean period. So there was self-rule from about 142 to 63 BC, but there was chaos, civil war, a lot of difficulties. I'm not an expert on the Maccabean period, but it looks to me like a lot of it was human effort. Remember I said God wasn't really speaking for 400 years? Just a lot of it, when I read it, I get the feeling like they were trying to make something happen for God, but it's not necessarily what God was into. You know, what they were doing and murdering and pillaging and doing all that kind of stuff to have Judaism back didn't look real godly to me. We get the zealots from this group. Remember one of Jesus' disciples, the zealot? These are the guys that came out of that said there was even assassins that were like, hey, we're gonna have Judaism come about, and we're going to do it by murder. Mm-hmm. So that's where we get the zealots. And one of Jesus, or at least one, maybe two of Jesus' disciples were zealots. They came from this Maccabean period. Like, kill them all, whatever it takes. So it was a significant time in the Maccabean period. But doesn't matter, because when the Romans showed up, it was game over. That was such a huge force, the Romans. We can't even identify the world power the Romans came. And they rolled through in 63, and it was game over. What they wanted, they got. But there was a Roman peace. Brutal, I mean, you know, but there was a peace in the land. Because the Romans had such power, they blew right through into Egypt and took over Egypt. And that provided a platform for the birth of Christianity in 63 BC. Because you could travel all over the Mediterranean, all over the known world, really, under the umbrella of the Romans. And that was the incubator for Christianity. So I want you to see how all these world forces are taking place, but at the same time, God's looking down, and he's orchestrating exactly, he knew what was going to come down, and he brings this Christian era into place. The Romans, You know, they allowed the native rulers to rule if they approved and they paid their taxes. So we have Herod the Great, which is kind of a half-Jew guy. And they're like, we're willing to let you do your Jewish stuff. There was approved religions. Judaism was one of the approved Roman religions. If you stay within your boundaries and just do your religious thing and pay your taxes and don't try to take over the government, and you say Caesar's the king and Caesar, well, we'll let you do it. So there was a quiet, even though the Romans were brutal, there was a quiet that they could allow to go back to. Not a lot of political stuff. It wasn't perfect by any means. Herod the Great expands and beautifies the Jewish temple just around, 30, 40, 50 B.C., just before Christ was born. He makes the second temple beautiful and marble and all this stuff. And, even some of that temple remains in the Wailing Wall. Am I right about that? It's Herod's temple, right? So some of that temple remains. And so he wanted to become a friend of the Jews, so he spent a whole bunch of money on the temple. And it was pretty cool. You know, about the time Jesus was born, there's this beautiful temple in Jerusalem and full-on worship and priests and marble and gorgeous, But Roman state religion basically borrowed Greek thinking. So they had their own names of their gods, but they just made Zeus, what was just Jupiter. They just took the idea of the gods that were mad at each other and had babies and killed each other and murdered their parents and just made it with Roman gods. So it wasn't that much better. But the thing that was the trick for the Jews and the Christians was, as the emperors grew in power, as we approached the beginning of the AD era, they figured, I'm divine. And the idea of a divine emperor started to come out, and you had to bow down and you had to worship the divine Roman Empire or emperor, or you got in big trouble. And that's where we see the Christian era starting. And later on, AD 50, 60, 70, 80, the persecution of the Christians because they wouldn't do it. They deny Jesus and say that he's God. No, I can't do that because God's God. Off with your head or whatever the issue was. So that's life under the Romans. Why am I telling you all this? Well, I think we need to understand that as the New Testament opens, where you're going to start reading tomorrow morning, we have got to understand how desperately the Jewish people were waiting for a deliverer. I can't imagine thousands of years of being under brutal foreign rule, but particularly, that last 6 years, 80 years before Christ's birth under the Romans, we just can't imagine the longing of the Jewish people for freedom. We got, who's my favorite? Braveheart. Freedom! We know that whole thing. We can't even imagine how much they would want that. They had it briefly in the Maccabean period, but it was so screwed up, all they did was fight with each other. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like, well, we had what we wanted, and we still couldn't pull it off. So they were just waiting for this deliverer. So now if you look back to September 24th in our first reading, the very first words you're going to read tomorrow are this. This is the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. Now, we open that up as Christians and go, oh, yeah, la, 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 blah, 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 blah. Hear how that would have sounded for a Jewish person, Messiah, the deliverer, the one to kick the Romans out and to get the worship straight and to break the backs of all of these pagan things that had happened. The Messiah, that your ears would perk up about that. And so we're going to see, I hope, as we do our New Testament reading, a much fresher way as we go through the Bible and say, man, the deliverer, as we start to read these stories of old ladies come up and holding Jesus and going, this is the one. Man, oh man, that meant something huge to them because they were waiting and waiting and waiting for the, could this be the one? Could this be the Messiah? Could this be the deliverer? Galatians 4, 4 to 5 says this, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under law, to redeem those who were under the law so that we might receive adoption as sons. I love that scripture, at the fullness of time. Jesus came at just the right time in world history. If you think about it, it's so significant. There was one language over the whole known world, the whole Mediterranean basin, Greek. Travel and roads, you've seen the Roman roads. Some of those are still in place now. These guys built these big thoroughfares and drained swamps and cut mountains and made these roads where you could get through the whole Roman Empire quickly with their forces. There was a peace. Yeah, it was a peace run by a pagan foreign country, but there was peace. Nobody was fighting anybody because there was nobody big enough to rebel because the Romans were so powerful. But there was peace. There was prosperity. There was trading. There was money to be made. There was businesses to start. It was a time of prosperity. It was a stable judicial system. It might not have been totally equitable, but at least you knew the rules. When Paul appealed to Caesar, remember that? You know, that's the judicial system. He goes to Caesar. Well, to Caesar you've appealed, to Caesar you'll go. The Gentiles were hungry, I think. You see the Gentile nations searching for God when Jesus shows up on the scene. Judaism was definitely ready. Things were pretty messed up in the Jewish faith when Jesus was born. There's all the Pharisees and all the laws and all this stuff we read about. It's just such a heavy weight of religion and burden and just so screwed up, so far away from what God's intention was when he gave the law. All these rules and stuff had been heaped on for the centuries on that. So Judaism was messed up. The Jewish people were hungry for something real, for God real. And then the temple, the Jewish temple, was destroyed in AD 70. The Romans sacked it and burned it to the ground. There was just a very small window when this whole world order came together. And what did God do right in the middle of all of those world events? He brings Jesus the Messiah, and he's born in a stable. And I guess I just want you to see the amazing foresight of God. When the scripture says God sees the beginning from the end, you know, we look back now in world history and think, wow, unbelievable. I can't think of any other time in history, if you were to birth Christianity, that I would do it other than this time now. Because it allowed the church to grow. The synagogues were in place throughout the whole Mediterranean region. So when Paul goes into some town, he looks up the Jews that are there, preaches in the synagogue, people get saved, the church starts. Just an amazing, amazing time for the birth of Christ. So as you read the Christ story, the birth story this week, don't think of Linus on the piano. Oh, do you know, and then the shepherds were in their watch point. Oh, isn't that cute? No. Think about the amazing world events that were taking place that dropped into the middle of that 1,000-year, 2,000-year mix to have God do just what he wanted to do at that time. So there's a little, quick little history lesson, and I hope it helps you twig your reading as you go this week. And let's take about 5-minute break, and we'll start back for some more stuff.